partisan politics, brinkmanship, shutting down of the government, the debt ceiling. Perhaps you could be forgiven for thinking that democracy is broken in the United States. But of course, people like the associate justices of the Supreme Court can't afford to think that way. They have to interpret the U.S. Constitution every single day. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer joins us, and he's spoken eloquently and extensively on the matter of the functioning of democracy in the United States. Stephen Breyer's latest book is Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. He joins us for the rest of the program from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Justice Breyer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
How do you, as a Supreme Court justice, gauge this question of is democracy working? We're seeing protests around the world, really expressing a lot of frustration at the lack of speed with which democracies tend to move.
Well, if you look back in history, after all, this country had a civil war. It had 80 years of racial segregation. It's had all kinds of ups and downs. But I think now there is a mood of being overly cynical or being cynical. Some is justified, but if there's too much cynicism, then the Constitution won't work. It can't, because people have to participate and they have to understand the government. That's why I've written on this subject. That's why I wrote the book. I can't solve the problem, but I can explain to people how my own institution, how the courts, how the Supreme Court works. And I think by explaining it and getting people to focus on it and its problems, I think that will help.
You have the long view of history, as is evidenced by your remarks just right there. But I'm wondering if you look at the situation with the debt ceiling and even the continuing resolution problems in Congress just this week over the budget of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, do you see the seeming proliferation of going to the brink kinds of votes in Congress as a fraying of the Constitution regarding the legislative branch?
Well, there have always I know that the people who wrote the document didn't think the democratic systems were easy to run. They wrote a document that was supposed to, and they believed would work over time. But whether it works or not depends upon whether the average American understands it and is willing to participate in the life of the community. It seems to me that when people think about it, they're pretty able to get together in the United States and to cooperate. I understand maybe that's whistling in the dark, but maybe it isn't. And in fact, there is a bet made by Adams and Jefferson and Hamilton and Madison and all the others. And the bet is that when people understand it, they will get together. We used to learn that in the fifth grade. You'd have study groups, and you'd have to pay attention to each other, and you'd have to cooperate. And I still think that's there. Maybe that's optimism, but I believe it will show justifiable.
We don't want to make too much news on the program this morning. Stephen Breyer, a Supreme Court Justice, author of Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. But you're not saying that it's optimistic to think that the Congress can behave like fifth graders, are you?
If Congress behaves like fifth graders, people who go to the polls will go and vote for people who don't behave like fifth graders. That's the wonderful thing. If you don't like what's going on, you can vote for somebody else.
Nice. So you've had a pretty interesting view of history in your time on the court. If we look at the Bush administration and then this first 3 years of the Obama administration, do you see an evolution in the relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch on everything from economic issues to national security issues?
Well, you have to remember, I work in the judicial branch of government, and I know that branch best. There have always been tensions, particularly in time of war, national emergency, between the Constitution's demands, for example, of securing our national security, and which is primarily the job of the president and Congress, and the judicial demands for securing civil rights of individuals. That's the kind of tension that's written into the Constitution. And what the most difficult job is for our court is to work out that kind of tension. That's why I'm better at explaining that, to tell you the truth, than in commenting on various people's political relationships.
Indeed. And let's talk about a case that you dissented on, the Citizens United case, which now really frames the 2012 election. It seems as though the majority decision is moving toward, the majority of the court is moving towards an official and explicit sort of statement that money equals speech and is fundamentally unregulatable in the political domain. You dissented. Do you see a way of doing that and bypassing this issue of money equals speech?
Well, I can say this much about it because it's a pretty recent case. And it beautifully frames the problem that I like to discuss. It frames it. I can't give you an answer. But the framing of the problem is this. I dissented in that case. I joined John Stevens' dissent, and it was a lengthy and, I thought, very convincing dissent. It's a very important case. It's a very unpopular case. Now, why is it that the average American should support not the result in that case particularly, but the institution of 9 unelected men and women were not elected, who will sometimes decide things that are very unpopular, and who will, because we are human beings, sometimes decide things completely wrong. All right, I think Bush v. Gore was wrong. Same problem. But I've heard Senator Reid say, for example, and I agree with this completely, the most remarkable thing about Bush v. Gore is that people disagreed with it, very unpopular, and I personally, Steve Breyer, think that it wasn't decided correctly. But they did follow it. No sticks and stones. No guns in the streets. And when I say that to audiences, I say some of you may be thinking it's too bad there weren't a few riots. I say, really? Turn on the television set and see what happens in countries that solve their problems through riots in the streets rather than under law. Every day I see in the courtroom people of all races, all religions, all points of view, and they really disagree. And they have decided in this country, 309 million of them, to resolve their major differences under law rather than through sticks, stones, riots, and guns. And that is a treasure.
We're going to pose some questions now that our listeners got the chance to submit by signing up to get our texts. You can text START to 69866, and we will pass a question on to Justice Breyer. Here's a question from John in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, Justice Breyer. Is it practical to interpret the Constitution as, quote, the Founding Fathers intended? In many ways, we are an alien race compared to what the world was in the late 1700s. And is our application of constitutional law evolving as rapidly as our technology and times?
Yeah, that's a very good question. What I think we do is we take the Constitution, which was written in the 18th century, and look at the underlying values. For example, the First Amendment protects free expression and free religion. Those values don't change, or at least not much. They're virtually permanent. But the difficulty for the judges and the lawyers in the country is how do those values apply to a world that is continuously changing? George Washington did not know about the internet, nor did Hamilton nor Madison. But we have to apply permanent values of free expression to a world with internet, television, your faxes, and so forth, which they never dreamt of or didn't talk about. Now, that's not an easy thing to do, but that's basically the job. And in some cases, we'll get it right, and I hope in most, and some we won't. But that's something that judges and ordinary citizens, and that's the kind of thing they have to deal with in the United States, not to change the value, but apply it to the changing circumstance.
Justice Breyer, if you do discover that Washington or Jefferson did know about the internet, I hope you'll write a book about
they
it.
They did.
Here's a listener in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Should oral arguments be televised? Would that help the citizenry be more engaged in court cases?
It's very controversial, and we are very conservative about our institution. All 9 of us really believe we don't want to do anything on our watch to harm an institution that's worked on balance pretty well for people over the course of 150 years. So we have questions. The oral argument is only about 5% of what we decide upon. Most of it is in writing. The oral argument focuses attention upon the people right in front of court. In fact, the law that we decide has to work for 309 million who aren't in front of the court, and they're invisible to the viewer. The oral argument on television always, of course, risks the possibility that there will be focus on this statement or that statement
sure.
to make someone look good or bad or foolish or not foolish, etc. So those are things people worry about. And I think over time, maybe their worries will be satisfied and they'll see that they're not too serious. But until there are pretty good answers to those questions, I think people will be cautious.
Before we take a break, here's a question that follows directly out of that. It's a great question. It's kind of a tough one. Do you ever feel entitled to influence the political process?
No. The answer is easy.
No.
It's not tough.
So you're...
It's
you...
not our job. Our job... Why? Why did... If we have 30 seconds, we better answer it after the break, because it's a really good question.
All right, but you vote, right?
Yes.
But you do not feel entitled to influence the political process. Why?
Absolutely not entitled. Like, that isn't the job at all. Tocqueville said this very well. When he came to the United States in 1840s, he said, you know, the first thing I notice is the clamor. Well, what did he mean by that? He meant everybody debating everything. And indeed, sometimes it's shouting and not very polite, but that's all right. They're debating. They're discussing. They're discussing what kinds of communities, towns, nation they want. And they discuss it in newspapers, on television programs, on radio programs, in groups, all kinds of different groups, in congresses and legislatures. And when we have a difficult problem, such as civil liberties and security, or such as some of the problems you've mentioned, or privacy in the press, and that discussion is about that. And people tentatively find ways of solving them, regulations maybe, sometimes a law, sometimes not, and they'll change around. Now, our court works best when it comes in at the end of that process, not beginning. And it works best, and its job is not to decide whether the process result is good or bad, whether it's good policy or not, but rather whether it fits within these very broad guidelines of the Constitution. In a sense, the Constitution sets the frontiers of our system. It sets the boundaries, and we're the boundary patrol. So the job is just to say whether it's inside or outside the boundary. Now, the second part of that is that a lot of people think we're just junior league politicians. Well, that's not true. I haven't seen matters decided on the basis of politics. We all think that's wrong. Nor even on ideology. Are you a Marxist or are you a Adam Smith free enterpriser? But rather, what you see so often in the 20 or 25% of the cases where there's a 5-4 division, because after all, 40% are unanimous, but
right.
nonetheless, where there is that division, I think what you're really seeing, and I've sort of come to this conclusion over time, is people have different backgrounds. I went to high school, public high school in San Francisco. I grew up there in the 50s. I've lived the life I've lived. And as you get older, you develop views in your profession or about what the country's like, what law is like, how law works well in the country. And at that very, very basic and abstract level of sort of philosophical approaches towards legal decisions, which are never computers, you know, your computers don't solve these problems. But on that very basic level, people have somewhat different approaches. And it's those different basic philosophical approaches that explain a lot of the differences. And in a country of 309 million people, all of whom think different things, it isn't so bad to have judges on the court who have somewhat different approaches.
Hmm. You know, you very eloquently make the case that you stay out of the headlines. You don't want to influence the political process.
Well, we
it's not your job.
Whether we're out of the headlines
right.
is your decision.
Right. That's true, I suppose. But as a news guy, I've got to ask you. I mean, from your perspective, you got a great seat to observe and be a part of American democracy, but it's not the same as my seat. I'm wondering if you ever get up in the morning, look at the headlines and go, oh, boy, that's on the way to me. For instance, this New York Times story this morning that the FBI apparently considers that it can hold people on a terrorism watch list even after they've been acquitted of crimes. Do you say to yourself, well, I'm going to have to be dealing with that eventually?
Yes, I think I do. I think that is right.
Shocked.
But I might better keep that fairly private. And I'm not always right about that. I mean, that's why if there is a big matter, you know, that I think is coming up, I don't have to read much about it, because if it really does come up in front of us, it will be beautifully well organized with every different view on this issue explained in briefs, and sometimes the important ones will be discussed orally, and we'll have time to think about it, discuss it, and read about it. And that is a virtue of the job. You don't have to respond to a headline. You respond to briefs and arguments and thoughts and information that you're given.
Now, this is kind of a sensitive question. I understand I don't want to prejudice or anything about something that might be on the court. But did you ever expect that the whole policy debate over health care might result in a constitutional test?
How did I know that you were going to ask about health care? And I've been very cautious on health care because it might come up. We don't know for sure, in which case I'll have to make a decision on it. So very disappointingly for you, what I decided is say nothing about health care whatsoever.
Well, I tried.
Yes, you did.
Here's a Detroit listener with a question. What do you think is the worst decision of the court in the last 10 years, and how do you think it will shape future cases?
I won't go back 10 years because I don't want to say on our court. I mean, I'm still sitting there. And my predictions too soon might be wrong. The worst probably in the history of the court was the Dred Scott decision, which said that the descendant of a slave could not ever be a citizen of the United States, and did a lot of other bad things beside. Another really bad decision was the Korematsu decision in 1944, where the country had taken 70,000 American citizens of Japanese origin who were blameless, had done nothing wrong, and moved them against their will to camps in the eastern part of California in the Intermountain region, moved them from their homes. And in 1944, the court 6-3 upheld that. Those are two pretty bad ones. The court has a history of some very bad decisions and some good ones. Plessy v. Ferguson, that's another very bad one.
I'm glad you mentioned the Japanese decision. That is an extraordinary. I always scratch my head that I can't believe that actually happened in the United States.
And try the Cherokee Indians, where the court said northern Georgia belongs to the Cherokee Indians, and the president of the United States, Andrew Jackson, said the court made its decision, now let it enforce it, and he sent troops to evict the Indians.
Wow. Norris in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, has this last question here, and I'm wondering if this is a logic problem or if this is a valid criticism. If corporations get the same rights as people, he writes, why doesn't it also work the other way around? Can you help Norris out here?
Well, I'm not sure what he's thinking of.
It seems like he resents the idea that corporations are...
He's talking about Citizens United. And there's a long dissent going into that issue, which he's trying to raise, which I joined, and it's pretty good. The constitutional provision that he's thinking of is the 14th Amendment, where it says no state shall deprive any person of due process of law, of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And it talks about person. And in the late 19th century, the court said that person includes corporations. But it didn't say, I mean, I can't think of the instance he's talking about.
But you don't believe corporations have an advantage?
I don't know of any instance like that. Maybe he's thinking of something. I don't know. But nothing comes to mind.
Stephen Breyer, Supreme Court Justice and author of Making Our Democracy Work. Do you have optimism about the future in terms of democracy working?
Yeah, my commercial message is let's restore the teaching of civics to the high schools so that people will, one, the younger generations will know how their government works, they'll know a little bit about history, and they'll understand the importance of participating in the community's life, in its political life, in its social life. It could be a library commission, it could be an education board, it could be in politics, it could be in many ways. But that document foresees that you and your children and my grandchildren will participate. And what I tell them is, I can't tell you what to do with your life, but I can tell you that if you don't participate with part of it in this process, that document won't work. That's what the founders thought.
Stephen Breyer, so is engagement by citizens possibly trumps money in the political process?
I always like to hope so.
All right.
And just, you say you get discouraged, well, then go out and convince somebody. And convince them you're right, and you get enough convinced, well, you win the election.
Convince Stephen Breyer of something, and that's quite a badge. Stephen Breyer, Supreme Court Justice and author of Making Our Democracy Work, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.